So how is your salesmanship? Dell's introduction couldn't have been any more appropriate to what I want to speak about today. So maybe we should put that into the recording of this message right about at this point so that people will know what I'm referring to. He even preempted one of my scriptures, but that's all right. We can handle that.
You know, my background was in real estate and teaching and various things, and I had an office full of salespeople, and kind of like herding chickens, really. But the thing that I tried to stress on them was how to be a proper type of salesperson. And for some reason, people think that to be a salesman, you got to have the gift of gab. I want to tell you, if you're going to be a salesman, that is the very worst thing you can do, is have that gift of gab. I've never seen it fail, because they always do. Someone who just talks all the time will be a failure. And I think that's true in all walks of life. And so there's a few things I want to bring out here. I used to teach this quite a bit on my group and just really stress it. It's titled The Value of Questions. But I just want to give you just a sample of how it starts out. Starts out here as the value of questions, which is the key to the unknown. Now, you are constantly negotiating your position in life. You may not know that, but really you are. You are constantly negotiating your position in life. That's what it's all about. Everything you need or want is presently owned by someone else. Everything that comes to you in this life must come to you from or through other people. You know, God designed it that way, because He wants people to be able to get along, communicate, help each other, and all grow. And it's there for a purpose. So, now, wouldn't the ability to get along, to communicate fluently, accurately, and compellingly be one of the principal ingredients of your success and happiness? Because it depends on other people, primarily. So, it's just as rising waters raise all boats, helping others fulfill their legitimate wants and needs carries with it its own rewards. And that's a truism. Always strive for a win-win-win situation. Win-win-win. Why is there three there? For you, for the person you're talking to, and for the results of what the two of you have decided. And it's very true in politics and everything else. So you always strive for a win-win-win settlement. You, your opponent, if it is an opponent, and those who your decisions affect. You got to keep all three in mind. There are three elements to that. Now, here is the main point, the key to everything on this. All the way through, I've got a bunch of stuff in here, and I'm going to bother you with that. But if you can do this one thing, this one thing. Let me say it again, all of you. Here it is. You can talk and tell. Or you can listen and learn. Think about that. You can talk and tell. So you're telling. Or you got the other choice. You can listen and you can learn. Now, if you talk the most, who learned the most? Who asked the most questions? Have you considered all points of view? How can you be sure your position is correct? if you listen the least and talk the most, was your goal accomplished? That's the essence of the whole thing there. You can talk and tell, or you can listen and learn. We are sent into this world as ambassador. Yeah, thank you. We are ambassadors. And so as an ambassador, we need to represent who we're representing, which is God in His kingdom. Now, that means we go out there and just talk, and stand on street corners and all that kind of stuff, or maybe carry a cross over your shoulder while you walk down the street. Well, it attracts attention, all right. But there again, you can talk and tell, or listen and learn. You don't know if your message is getting across if you don't get some feedback. And that was the main thing I always tell my salespeople. If you don't get any objections coming in, how do you know where they're coming from? How do you know they're getting a message? Always be glad to get an objection, because now you know how to answer something. You know that, and that prepares you as well. There's one thing that if a person can do it, and this is hard, believe me. When you're having a conversation, and this is what I would do once in a while when I had nerve enough to do it, is I take a recorder, set it on my desk, and when I'm interviewing someone, just tell them. I says, I want to record our conversation because I want to review it later, because I'm going to be thinking while you're talking, I'm going to miss something you say. And that's true. Exactly true. But there was another thing that I didn't tell them. When I played that recording back, I'd be listening to myself as much as them. And if I heard my voice more than theirs, I knew I had lost it. And I'll tell you what, you try that one time. You try that one time, and you will be shocked. Because in that conversation, you will find, more than likely, that you have totally dominated that conversation, and you don't even have any idea what those other people was talking about or wanting. And it happens every time. And that's why it's hard to do, because it's an embarrassment to you. It embarrasses you, something terrible, to hear that you have totally dominated that conversation when you're trying to help them. What you're doing, you're lecturing. Lecturing don't work. So, I'm going to put lecturing now in.
Our life, once we're called, is about salesmanship in a way. That should be obvious, but sometimes it isn't. Jesus Christ made reference to that in a peculiar way, but it was relevant to the people that he was approaching at that point in time, where he said in Matthew 4:19, a very common passage, one that we all remember from our early years in kindergarten Sunday school, if we had that experience, but where he said, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." And most people react, "Who, me?" Was it just the disciples that he was saying that to? Was it just to those people who became the apostles later? Well, obviously not, because each generation comes along and the commission, if we want to call it that, is passed on to the next generation. We are to become fishers of men, but also we need to notice that it is He who will make us fishers of men. This is what we're supposed to be doing. Now, in our earlier experience, especially coming into the truth, we were discouraged from any idea of doing such a thing. The ministry did not want us as novices, as first being first introduced to the truth, to go out and be evangelizers or to collar everyone we know and to try to get them to understand what we understand. Any of us who have ever tried that realize that, especially with someone who's a novice in the truth, can make a lot of mistakes, can turn a lot of people off, and can get absolutely nowhere. So the ministry's discouragement of us, in a way, was appropriate at the time. But are we to always remain that way? That's the question. Are we to always remain in the background and let someone else do it? Fishing is an interesting activity. People use it for different reasons. Some people fish to live. Other people live to fish. Some people use it as a form of relaxation. With others, it's a sport, a trophy sport. We have different reasons for doing what we do. But if Christ is speaking to each of us, we are to become fishers of men. In Hebrews 5, verse 14, we can get an idea of what our long-term experience should result in. 5:14. And strong meat, obviously, is not for the new person. It's something we grow into, our ability to handle. Strong meat belongs to them that are of full age, even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. With time in the faith, there should be the development through having our senses exercised to be discerning and to be able to serve in varying capacities, particularly as it involves being fishers of men. It's not an easy thing, because religion, for the most part, turns most people off. I found this quote recently, and boy, does it fit. But it says, faith in the past was philosophically divorced from reason. Which is saying religion is often technically illogical. There are so many things in religion that a rational, untaught person would believe to be completely illogical. And they would think we're weird, or imbalanced at least, to believe such things. Faith has been philosophically divorced from reason. And it's true. So being illogical to most people, many are turned off by anything theological. What hope is there for that segment of society? What can we do? What can we say that will reduce that reaction or that aversion among most people? And this is where the idea of becoming fishers of men come into play. Our experience and our training in the faith should eventually pay off with usable results. There's a lot of mistakes that a novice fisherman can make. Number one, you have to know the fish. What kind of fish are you after? If you're going deep sea fishing, you might be fishing for halibut or cod or something. Those are bottom feeders. They're not going to come to the surface. Fly casting doesn't work in that situation. Or if you're going to river fish where there's a lot of weeds and stuff, you've got to know where to land your hook that you don't catch snags all the time. and where you can draw out the bass or the perch or whatever. Different kind of fish involve different situations. You've got to know what you're fishing for, whether they're on the bottom or whether they come to the top, whether a fly will work or whether you need heavy bait. You've got to know the fish. But not just knowing the fish, you've got to have the technique. Some things work, some things don't. There was a woman that went fishing with her husband, and she came back and was talking to her friends, and she said, I did everything all wrong again. I talked too much. I was too loud. I used the wrong bait and the wrong lures. And most of all, I kept reeling in too soon. And worst of all, I caught more fish than he did. Accidents do happen. But you got to know the technique. And maybe an accidental technique is just as good as, you know, the expert. How many times have you seen the expert out there fishing with all his wonderful gear and hip waders and big lure box and wonderful creel, nothing in it. And some kid comes along on the shore and he pulls in a couple of beauties, you know. How can you? Anyway, you have to know the fish and you have to know the technique sometimes. And so I suppose sometimes there are fish that are willing to bite on anything. I found out that one time when I was fishing in a river and it was full of yellow perch. I was catching them about one every 15 minutes. I just gave up. It was boring after a while. But some fish will bite on anything. You never know. But you have to know the fish, which involves that discernment thing that we talked about in Hebrews 5:14. What precautions do we need to develop in order to be a good fisherman? A novice fisherman can be their own worst enemy at times. It's not the equipment that makes a good fisherman. It doesn't matter how much you spend on your equipment. A lot of times it has to do with the approach. I used to love to fish small streams. And with a small stream, you've got to sneak up on that fish. You cannot make a sound. You cannot snap a twig. You've got to sneak up. You got to drop your hook or your bait in just above a little falls where there's a pool down below and let that work its way down into the hole. And then you catch the trout that's hiding in there. But if he sees your shadow, or if he hears your feet or anything, forget it. Small stream fishing is a real challenge, but it's kind of fun in a way. But different situations call for different approaches. And that's where discernment comes in. To be able to figure out what is the best approach for that particular fish. Speaking of people, because we interface with all kinds of people. We can send out a broadcast, and that's somewhat like fishing with a net. And you'll pull in some you keep, some you don't. But the direct one-on-one fishing experience is more like using a pole and a hook. Because that's where most of us are. We're not broadcasters ourselves. We're not on the public forum ourselves. We are individuals and we rub shoulders with people all the time. Those also are the kind of people that we want to be thinking about as it applies to this activity of being fishers of men. There's two mentalities that go with this activity, and either one can have its own negative effect. But one is carnality, and the other is unbridled enthusiasm. And that's where we all started from, let's face it. We need to consider what kind of bait, what kind of approach is effective and what is not. Because the same thing doesn't work with all different people. Each person needs to be considered as to where they're coming from, what they're thinking about, what their background, their orientation is. Because it's so easy to make a mistake that turns them off And a lot of times there's only one chance to drop an acceptable bait at the right time. Right here in this same passage we were just looking at, we were in verse 14, back up to verse 12, Hebrews 5, verse 12. Paul is saying that, you know, when for all this time you ought to be teachers. He was faulting those people because they hadn't really grown much after years and years in the faith. They were still sitting there waiting to be spoon-fed the basics. You have need that one teach you again, which be the first principles, the oracles of God, and are become such as have need of milk and not of strong meat. He was faulting them because they weren't doing what they should be doing with respect to growing to the point where they could be useful teachers in God's hand. And we could say to ourselves, if the shoe fits. There are many ways that we can approach people that are big turnoffs. We could be arrogant. We could put on a know-it-all stance. We could be over-enthusiastic. We could become irrational and say something that really makes no believable sense in that situation. We could be inconsiderate or ignorant of their beliefs. We have to respect people's current belief system, many of whom have grown up in it all of their lives, and they're not about to throw it off over a simple comment. We've got to be careful on how we and what kind of bait and how we place it. Very important. We need to present bait appropriate to the situation. If we're too overcorrective, we lose people. You make too much noise in the boat, stomp around, talk, laugh, and drop things in the water, you're not going to have a very good catch that day. Our enthusiasm doesn't resonate with people new to the idea. More often than not, it does not resonate. We might be excited about something, but we have to understand people are skittish. They can be scared off by any of those faults. Now, we were told years ago that we were to teach by example. We could turn to Philippians 2:15 regarding that. Philippians 2:15. And that wasn't bad advice at the time. It's not bad advice at any time. But the implication was that we were just to be an example and keep our mouth shut. To throw a basket over our light, you could say. Or to never let that light express any thought in words. Philippians 2:15. Let's look at that. And this refers to our example. Even being a complainer, look at verse 14, can somewhat muddy the waters. Do all things without murmurings and disputings. That's something we tend to do in a situation. We love to dispute. Well, there's times when that's appropriate and times to avoid it. That you may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God without rebuke in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation among whom you shine as lights in the world. If our light doesn't match our words, think of the effect it can have. I recall a situation back when I lived in Springfield, Massachusetts. I was on lunch hour one day walking around the downtown streets, and I walked by this restaurant, and out in front of it there was a man talking with a bunch of other men, telling somewhat doubtful stories to one another. And I saw him, and I don't know that he recognized me. He had just begun attending the Hartford Church. But he was telling stories, swapping tales. And I couldn't help but think at the time, what does that example leave in the minds of those friends of his? Could he ever witness to them after sharing those doubtful stories? And it makes you think, our light needs to match what we say. So it was good advice in a way, as long as we don't say that we're only to shine our light for the rest of our lives and never do or say anything more than that. I don't think that's what God wants of us. I think He expects we're to be His representatives. We are ambassadors of Him on this earth. 2 Corinthians 5:20. 2 Corinthians 5:20. Now then, we are ambassadors for Christ, as though God did beseech you by us. We pray you in Christ's stead, because you reconciled to God. For He has made Him to be sin for us, who knew no sin, that we might be made the righteousness of God in Him. Again, alluding to our light. But there's no ambassador that's sent over to another country who just sits there and never does or say anything. It's obvious. If we're ambassadors, we represent Him in some capacity. Now, we don't all have the same abilities, that's fine. But God gives us certain abilities appropriate to our talent level. We need to be fully equipped. We know that passage that talks about the whole armor of God. We need to be fully equipped for both defense and offense. We need to be consistent and not confusing people or even one another with doubtful doctrines. There are many of those around. Things that are questionable. Interesting, perhaps. But is that our main presentation? Is that our bait? Something that's doubtful. We're discouraged in the Scriptures for doing that, especially as it regards a new person. Don't drag a new person through something that is doubtful. One of the requirements for being effective is humility. Humility is a rare commodity these days, real humility. It's not a popular characteristic in today's culture. And it's not really the same thing as timidity. Some people are timid and that's perceived to be humble. Most people disrespect someone who's overly timid. They just don't have a lot of credibility. Humility is different. It's possible to be assertive and still be humble. Christ was. He was humble. He left us an example of that. Humility is the opposite of having an exalted viewpoint of one's own self-importance. That's basically it. And how many of our prima donna church leaders would benefit from that consideration? We don't come on as though we have all the answers. We don't have all the answers to everything. Humility is a virtue that allows us to work with those who aren't humble. And if that other person is humble, all the better. But it gives us an advantage. You could say fishermen are sneaky. In some situations they have to be, because they don't want to alert the fish to their presence. Fish aren't going to bite if they know what's coming their way. It's got a hook in it. We need to be wise. We'll come to that. But humility is the first one. Let's consider James chapter 4, verse 10. James 4:10. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and He shall lift you up. Simple statement. Profound picture. He will lift you up. It's His strength by which we do things, if we do them humbly, giving Him the proper credit. We can't underestimate the presence of humility. It makes another person receptive in certain circumstances, if they are humble. Again, we have to take into account the nature of our quarry. Philippians 2:8. Speaking of Christ, and being found in fashion as a man, He humbled Himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. There's a kind of humility that penetrates people's defenses. And that's why arrogance or acting like a know-it-all can turn people off. But humility can reach through people's defenses. We need to also keep in mind there's a kind of humility that people automatically dismiss as insincere, which sometimes it can be. How do we come across? That's the question. It's important that we accurately assess the orientation of the person that we're approaching. In Micah 6:8, he says, He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. Our witness must be consistent with our character and consistent with our relationship with God. Our humility is one key in the process by which God brings a person to salvation. And, oh yeah, we need to realize the humility of the other person can be a factor. God knows who He can call at this time. We can't accurately second guess. However, He does use us to plant the seed, a seed which may germinate someday. But the fact that we don't know who God can call or who He will call or who He's planning to call now doesn't give us excuse to make no effort. Wisdom is another factor in being a successful fisher of men. Paul explained his approach in 1 Corinthians 9, starting in verse 19. 1 Corinthians 9. And he demonstrated some of this that we're talking about. Verse 19. For though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant unto all, that I might gain the more. He's looking to gain people. How? Verse 20. And unto the Jews I became as a Jew. He oriented his approach to their orientation, that I might gain the Jews, to them that are under the law as under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law, to them that are without the law as without the law, being not without the law, but within the law to Christ, as I should read, that I might gain them that are without the law. For to the weak I became as weak, that I might gain the weak. I am made all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. Paul altered his approach based on what he perceived the hearer to be. And this isn't a group situation now. The way Paul is writing here, it's talking about a one-on-one. He takes into account where they're coming from. And it's what we have to do. That's where the wisdom factor plays in. Whether a person is religious or not. Whether they're intellectual or not. Whether they're knowledgeable or not. Whether they're guilt-ridden or whether they're self-justifying. All of those things are important factors that we need to take into account when we're talking to someone. We have to, like Del said, listen as much as speak, because we've got to know where they're coming from. To be effective. To know what kind of bait to lay in front of them. Sounds a little crude, but it's really practical. If we want to be good fishers of men. As Kenny Rogers once said, we have to know when to hold them, know when to fold them, know when to walk away, know when to run. We don't know what reaction we're going to get, and we have to be listening carefully to discern any shift in response so that we can steer it in a positive way rather than magnify the negative reaction. We have to use wisdom. In Luke 22:15, Christ said, "For I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all of your adversaries shall not be able to gainsay nor resist." What that's telling us is, in a right situation, He will provide our thoughts and our words. We're ambassadors for Him, after all. And the ambassador works on the instructions that they're given from their government that sent them out. He will provide our thoughts and our words. When we trust in God, it provides the assurance that God is with us at all times, even when our troubles seem overwhelming. Trusting in God is an antidote for any negative mental situation that we might be in, whether we're discouraged or whatever it might be. God expects Christians to develop trust in Him. He opens our minds to understanding of His truths. Wisdom is important. Knowledge is another essential. Knowledge with understanding. In Proverbs 3:13 and 4:7, we read these: "Happy is the man that finds wisdom and the man that gets understanding. Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all thy getting, get understanding." There's nothing worse than trying to convince someone with a piece of information that's not correct. When they know it's not correct, they're not going to bite. We're to grow in grace and knowledge. But grace, to be effective, has to be applied through wisdom. Effective study is also important. That's part of knowledge. 2 Timothy 2:15. "Study to show yourself approved unto God." God is looking to approve what we know and what we do with what we know. And we need to study the Word to know that we have it right. Being wrong in our facts can seriously undermine our credibility, and not only at the time, but also long term. Once we've represented something that wasn't true, the person's going to remember that for a long time. But we don't need to have perfect lives to be a good fisherman. In Acts 20:19, I'm going to just read some of these quickly to save us time. In Acts 20:19, "Serving the Lord with all humility of mind and with many tears and temptations which befell me." Our lives don't need to be mellowed out and perfect before we're useful. 2 Corinthians 3:4-5. Such trust have we through Christ toward God, not that we are sufficient of ourselves to think anything of ourselves, but our sufficiency is of God. These are all contributing factors to landing that trophy fish. Let's look at James 5, verse 20. James 5:20. And this can involve not just people out in the world that have no religious interest, but this can affect anyone we know. Let him know that he which converts the sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death and shall hide a multitude of sins. Whose sins are being hidden here? Interesting possibility. The other person's or one's own? Interesting to consider. So we have humility, wisdom, and knowledge. But you still can't land the fish without the right bait. So now, let's consider the bait. What we put before people can be off-putting. I don't know of too many people that go fishing using pickles for bait. Don't get too many strikes on that. It's easy to put on the hooks, wonderful. But you got to use the right bait. Squid doesn't work, I don't think, in a freshwater stream. Worms are great there, because freshwater fish have seen worms. Ocean fish probably haven't. I don't know. Never tried that. But how many times do we say the wrong things? Wish we had a do-over. Oh, boy. If I'd only said that instead of what I said. Oh, boy. When we're fishing, we have to ask, what is the best approach? I've heard this many times. I've cringed a lot of it, a lot of times. But when someone is introducing a new person to our belief system, guess what they throw up first? I'll bet you already know. We keep the Sabbath and holy days. First thing, wonderful. True. Relevant. Important, yes. But when you're talking to someone who all their lives has been oriented to Sunday and Christmas and Easter, when you put that one out there, automatic turnoff. A friend of my mother's used to attend our Baptist church when I was a kid. I was listening to Garner Ted on the radio. Loved it. Couldn't get enough of it. Until one day, Garner Ted mentioned the Sabbath and the holy days. She was gone. Gone. That was so foreign to her religious orientation, it was immediately unacceptable. Older lady, been in the church, that church, all her life. But it was an immediate turnoff. And we need to be careful about that. There are some people where that's an attractive thing to say, but most of the time, that's not what to put up front. That's not first bait. Our religious orientations, or people's religious orientations, can sometimes be very deeply set. You can read in Revelation 14, verse 9, where it talks about people, even after the millennial kingdom is established, people are warned to not to go back to the beast worship system. They already know where God stands on that. They've already been advised by His angels publicly. And yet there is going to be the tendency to go back to that, and He has to precaution them against it. Because there are people who have been steeped in that for so much of their lives that they think, even after Christ's return, that there was still something right about that. And they tend to go back to it. How much more today in this world? It's rare for our Sabbath and Holy Days presentation to be, or to create a positive response. That's not the best thing to put up front. No respect to its importance. But we realize it's important to us. It's important to those who are biblically oriented and not religiously oriented. It's important to those people who are of that persuasion. But to someone new, be careful with that one. We need to use our wisdom and our discernment skills to assess what the hearer will accept hearing. A person's religious background can heavily flavor a conversation. They can be the light switch. What we say can be the light switch, either off or on. And a lot of times, so much of the time, we only get one chance with someone. So what would you put out there? Think about it. What would you put on the hook? What would you use for bait? Keep in mind, we want to entice them to ask something further. We want to hold their thought. We want to make them aware that there is something they don't know about. We want to cause them to ask another question. They're at least fiddling with the bait. Okay? What would you put out there? What would you say first? Of course, depending on, you need to know a little bit something about their background or where they're oriented religiously. I would suggest things that are familiar but not controversial at first. Let's consider some of these. What if we said to someone, and whether they're religious or not, this one might fly, the world isn't going to end anytime soon. Now that contradicts most religious teachings, but it's true. We could explain that. The world is not going to end anytime soon. It's a fundamental teaching, and there's a lot of things that are woven into that. Armageddon is not the end of the world. What? All our TV documentaries are... our movies are suggesting that Armageddon is the end. Oh, no, it's not. It's not the end of the world. We could pose to people that there's a better future beyond Armageddon than religion typically predicts. This one may not fly in with all people, but we could say Christ will rule here on earth for 1,000 years. Now that one has some serious implications. His saints will rule with him. Here's a big one, and especially this would work with someone who's had non-religious relatives. We could say all will eventually have an opportunity for salvation. Look at the doors that one opens up. How can that happen? The resurrection that's going to occur at the second coming, and most religious people are somewhat familiar with that, the resurrection at the second coming is not the only one to occur. Does that open a door or close it? Again, depending on who you're talking to, but there are things that can entice them to consider what you're saying and to go a little further with a question. If you can get that feedback, if you can get that question back, you've made some progress. Another one we could pose to people. Death remains an unconscious state until the resurrection. And there's a lot of scripture we can use to back that one up. But think of what implications that has to the typical religious belief system. Humility, wisdom, and knowledge. To be a good fisherman, we need to know what's appropriate in any situation. These are important factors in being a successful fisher of men. Let's get on with it.